Good morrow. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. One of my favorite people that I've enjoyed watching on television and listening to the radio over the course of the last few decades has also been somebody that I've been lucky enough to get to know and befriend over the last 13 or 14 years. And as long as we've known one another and as many stories as I've heard him tell, either to me in real life or to everybody on the radio or on television, I'm always amazed at the depth of his knowledge about everything. I'm always amazed that there's a new story that I haven't heard. And lo and behold, he has this terrific new book out where he not only showcases what an international man of mystery he is, but he writes about one of the most incredible literary and historical factors in history. I want to welcome legendary film critic. You know him from television programs like Sneak Previews and Real Talk, but you may also know him from radio. He's the author of the new book, Hemingway and Me, Letters, Anecdotes, and Memories of a Life-Changing Friendship. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome the one and only Jeffrey Lyons. Jeffrey, how are you, my friend?
I'm honored to be here. It's one of two books that just come out. The other is the all-time Boston Red Sox books. I wrote them at the same time, more or less. I don't know how I did it. You know, Da Vinci wrote with both hands. I get the feeling I did that. If they overlapped, I would say, you know, Hemingway in his spare time played some mean shortstop. But they both came out May 1st, so I'm pretty excited about
that.
Well,
I do want to have you back next week to do an extended discussion on the Red Sox book. But if you're a Red Sox fan or just a baseball fan in general, I definitely do recommend Boston Red Sox, the all-time All-Stars, where you list the best players at each position for the Red Sox. Mm-hmm. I'd love to read a book about how you came as a lifelong New Yorker to be the number one Red Sox fan in the country.
Frank, why does love have to be explained? Why do we love the people we love? Why does my wife like vanilla and I like chocolate? Why? Certain things are better left unsaid and unexplained. It would take all the karma and the mystery out of it if it explained it.
Well, fair enough. Now, you have described getting to know some very noteworthy and very famous people from the time that you were a child. And so to put this in proper context, you did not have the typical childhood. Most people don't have Marilyn Monroe and Joe DiMaggio having coffee in their parents' living room. Why is it? Explain to folks how your father, Leonard Lyons, and his job and his profession led you to have so many incredible relationships with so many folks, including Hemingway, from such a young age.
Well, my dad was the son of a Romanian tailor who came here about 1900 and died when my father was 16. And he was the youngest of five children, and his mother ran a candy stand on the Lower East Side, and he went to the first he was second in his class in the first graduating class of St. John's Law School, and he practiced law for a while, but he wanted to be a Broadway columnist, and it was the time when there were 11, 12, 13 daily newspapers. If you hear the World Telegram and Sun, that's three papers back then. All these mergers hadn't happened. And he began to accumulate a scrapbook of items he had contributed to other columnists of the day. And then when the Daily Mirror hired Walter Winchell, who became my father's primary rival, the New York Post, a very different paper back then, I might add, wanted a columnist with an alliterative name. So Leonard Sucher was renamed Leonard Lyons First, he wrote for the English page of the Jewish Daily Forward, which is still being published. And he was hired. He beat out 500 other people for a 2-week trial, and then they hired him. And he was to write for 40 years to the day, from May 20th, 1934, to May 20th, 1974. That's 12,478 columns, 6 days a week, 1,000 words a day. No internet, no electric typewriters for most of those years. He had to go out and get his own stories twice a day.
Amazing.
And he quickly gained the reputation of being not a gossip columnist. He didn't write the way Winchell did about who was sleeping with who or who was, in other words, didn't have his eye to the keyhole. And he would table hop at Sardi's, at 21, all the restaurants of the day, and he'd write the column. And he gained the confidence of the people that he talked to, and in exchange, they gave him exclusive stories. You wouldn't read his stories anywhere else. And one of those people was Ernest Hemingway. And I wrote two books about my dad's columns, And the most person, the name that appeared in the most columns was FDR. Second was Eleanor Roosevelt, and third was Ernest Hemingway. And they began to be friends, and Hemingway was, in 1940, Hemingway and Martha Gellhorn bought their house near Havana, and my father would send him the columns every week, and that was Hemingway's one touch with what was going on in New York.
Wow.
He eagerly awaited the columns. And eventually, when I had three brothers, and my two older brothers and I accompanied my parents on a visit to Hemingway's home in 1952, and I was 7 years old, and he taught me how to fire a gun, and I grew up watching cowboy shows on TV, and he told me that there were bandits in the hills, and my God, I don't know who this man with the beard is, but he's my hero right now. And he gave me a 22 rifle. I have the movie to show it. I have the films to show it. And he put bottles up on the wall. And then a few years later, in 1956, my parents took me to Spain for the first time, and I fell in love with Spain. And Richard Condon, who wrote The Manchurian Candidate and Prizzi's Honor, took me to something called the Bullfight. Changed my life. And Ernest and Mary heard that I was enthralled by this. A strange thing to be. It's indefensible. I want to say that right away. I can't defend it. But anyway, he arranged for me a month before he died to travel with his godson, Antonio Ordóñez, who was the LeBron James of bullfighting, the Michael Jordan of bullfighting. Hemingway, in fact, wrote The Dangerous Summer about the rivalry in 1959 between Ordóñez and Luis Miguel Dominguín, who was Ava Gardner's boyfriend. And it forged a lifelong friendship between me and Antonio, and I spent 7 summers touring with him. So it really was life-changing. And the two of them, my father and Ernest Hemingway, could not have been more unlike. But they loved that about each other. Hemingway would go hunting, when hunting was not what it is today, when it was, I guess, acceptable. But he would stand and accept the charge of the elephant. He wouldn't fire from 100 yards away. And my father would go hunting for stories in nightclubs. And one day, Hemingway invited my father to go to Abercrombie & Fitch in the basement. They had a shooting range on Madison Avenue. And he said, Lenny, come on down. I want you to test my elephant gun with me. And my father had never had much use for the word recoil. So he picked up the gun, and I think when he fired it, he must have wound up on Lexington Avenue with a separated shoulder. And they really, and in the letters that are in the book, Hemingway talks about his pet peeves and the people he liked and the people he didn't like, and he aired a lot of problems that he had with a lot of other journalists and a lot of other people of the day, and it gives a very revealing insight into him.
No, it certainly does. And your father was actually the person that announced Hemingway's death to the world, and you write that was actually done at the request of Hemingway's wife, Mary.
Well, when she found the body that awful day, I think it was July 2nd, 1961, he had shot himself. And she called my father before she called the police in Ketchum, Idaho. And I was in Spain with Antonio. And that night, most bullfights are held in the late afternoon, but that was a nighttime charity fight in which the bullfighters dress up in what's called traje corto. In other words, with chaps and the bolero hat jackets and the big hats. And he got the word, and it spread slowly around the arena in southern Spain, and he went to the middle of the arena. The bull was being distracted at the other end, and he knelt down on his one knee and dedicated the death of the bull to his godfather, and I'll never forget that. Yeah, and my dad was in a rare trip to L.A. He didn't go to L.A. too often, but he happened to be in L.A. that time, and they finally tracked him down, and he told the world. When Hemingway was in two plane crashes in 1954, when he was in Kenya with Mary, and their plane crashed, and the rescue plane crashed. Can you believe that? The whole world thought he had died. And my father was the only journalist who said, wait, we don't know yet. We have to wait. And but if it's the case, and he wrote a tribute column, but he said, wait, we're not sure. And it happened that Hemingway was not killed then. And Ernest liked that about him. And Mary was a good friend of mine. And I was a little young to be entirely conversing with that with Ernest, but Mary was a good friend of mine.
Talking with Jeffrey Lyons, he's the author of the new book, Hemingway and Me, Letters, Anecdotes, and Memories of a Life-Changing Friendship. The foreword, actually written by Liam Neeson. Liam Neeson, was that his idea to write the foreword?
What happened was Liam Neeson and I got together to help save the carriage horses. When de Blasio tried to tried to get rid of them and came up with all sorts of, you know, excuses. And because one of his donors wanted to raise, R-A-Z-E, raise, tear down the stables, the state-of-the-art stables, and build another glass skyscraper. And this is the carriage horses in New York are what the, you know, the swan boats are to Boston, the gondolas are to Venice, the cable cars are to San Francisco, the tulips are to Amsterdam. They're a symbol of New York. And so he and I started communicating, and I told him about this book. And he didn't grow up reading Hemingway, but he certainly would have liked to. And he was very accommodating, and I owe a lot to him. Doesn't affect what I would review one of his, how I would review one of his movies, but he's a great guy. He really is. And you know, he'll do one action film, make a lot of money, and then do something offbeat. He did another movie right after he did one of his action films about the death of a child. And the film make money, but you get a satisfaction about it. A lot of great actors can take that luxury. Look at that. Look at Helen Mirren. She's in, you know, the latest Shoot 'em Up, you know, and right. What's it called?
Fast and the Furious 900.
She wander in from a Shakespearean play, but they do that. And they make a ton of money, and then they can make the kind of films that they want. So that's how we became friends.
Jeffrey, now it's been 60 years since Ernest Hemingway passed away. A lot of people that have come of age over the last three generations, they know Ernest Hemingway's name. They know him as a great writer. They know him as somebody that the Ken Burns documentary focuses on. But I'm wondering if you can describe Ernest Hemingway as a personality. You said that he taught you to shoot, but what was it like to just be around Ernest Hemingway, to experience him, to hang out with him?
Well, he was larger than life, especially when you're a child. You look up, he looked like a tall tree. And I could see, though, that, and you can see it in the short film clips I have, of how he welcomed my family that day in Havana, at their finca outside Havana. And I found when we went to Cuba in 2017, I went with Joe Castiglione, the Red Sox radio announcer, and his wife. And I sent word ahead that we were coming, and I had copies of letters from him, which I donated to the museum there. And you could see that there was such a friendship and such an attraction. He called my father Lenny or Kid, and because they were so different and such unlikely friends. And you could see that there was a kindness. Now, Ken Burns' movie was just, as always, wonderful. But it also included that he had, you know, he drank a lot and he had trouble with his kids and all this and that, and married four times. I didn't see that, of course, and I saw another side of him. And what he did, arrange for me to travel with his godson, was really a special favor, and it changed my life. I never had to open a Spanish book again in school, never. And I walked in, my friend spoke Spanish the way Mickey Mantle spoke English, you know, deep Southern accent, and to the horror of my teachers. But it helped me. When I was going to interview Penelope Cruz, she was terrified. She didn't speak good English when she came to my set at WNBC, and I suddenly started speaking to her in her dialect of Spanish, and I had made a friend for life. It really is true. And my son traveled with Antonio's grandson, and 60 Minutes did a whole piece on the two grandsons of him, because they became great bullfighters. And it's just a part of Spain that is fading away, I think. But I was very lucky. And, you know, I grew up one day, if I may just digress for a minute, the kind of friendship I had, the kind of childhood I had. My parents had one of the first TV sets in New York. And my brothers and I were fighting over who gets to watch which channel. And in walks Dr. Ralph Bunche, who had just won the Nobel Peace Prize for settling the first Arab-Israeli war. So my father said, "Dr. Bunche, you settled the war in the Middle East. Please settle the war in our living room." And he pulled out a quarter and flipped a coin. I mean, this kind of stuff was regular fare in my parents' house. My dad gave a party for Ethel Barrymore one year. She was a big baseball fan. And I woke up and heard all the guests in the living room, and I walked into my pajamas, and I walked over to the only person I recognized, Joe DiMaggio, and I said, "You're the best guest here." And everybody had laughed. And I saw him three decades later at Shea Stadium, and he said, "Would you still say that?" And in the interim, Frank, I found a list of the guests that night in our living room. It was Ernest Hemingway, Adlai Stevenson, Marlene Dietrich, Comden and Green, Edward G. Robinson, but none of them could hit a curveball.
I thought your answer to that would have been, "No, I wouldn't have said it if Dom was in the room."
Well, Dominic, one day, and it's in my Red Sox book, one day Marilyn was sweeping out the driveway wearing short shorts, and Dominic pulled up and he stared at his sister-in-law, and Joe noticed this. He said, "Yeah, Dominic, and she can cook too."
Jeffrey Lyons, A Story for Every Occasion, and they're all in this book. Well, not all of them, but a lot of the Hemingway stories are in the book. Yeah. Hemingway and Me, I do recommend it. The foreword is by Liam Neeson, and if you're a baseball fan, you're going to want to check out this book, The Boston Red Sox All-Time All-Stars. Jeffrey, very quickly, though, let me take quick advantage of your film expertise, having reviewed more films than anybody. Now that theaters are reopened, is there anything out in theaters now that you think is really worth seeing?
Not yet. I was disappointed with Cruella. I thought it was much too long. I couldn't just find a discerning audience other than the fashionistas to it. So I live in hope. You know, the night before I became a critic in 1970, Oscar winner Ruth Gordon said to me, Sonny, she was from Quincy, Mass. Sonny, you're starting your career tomorrow. Think twice before you make fun of somebody else's work. And I've always tried to do that. That was my watchword. So I'm not even sure that theaters are all going to be the same. We just don't know. People might go to Netflix or see things online more. And I don't know if that's good or bad. There's nothing like seeing it in a big screen. But also, if a movie's good, it's good even if it's on your little handheld device. It's better to see it as it was intended. But I'm still seeing 3 or 4 or 5 movies a week, and it can be a grind. But I've done 15 or 16,000 films, so that's a wasted life.
I don't know about that. I think I would venture to say anything. But, Jeffrey, thank you so much for the time this morning. Let's do this again soon. We'll talk Red Sox.
Thanks, Frank.
The Jeffrey Lyons, if you want to comment on any portion of our conversation, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.